fence, so a fence waller piece there. We've talked about fence in a couple of these sections already. New York guy, and one of these early jazz pianists that we keep talking about, because what we have here is a piano. And so we talk about piano players. Fats wrote, composed many, many tunes that are still played by everybody who plays this kind of vintage music and this vintage jazz. This one is called Keeping Out of Mischief Now, and I just use it as a kind of warm-up piece once in a while. But while we're talking about him, he can play some pretty sweet things as well. And I'm going to play something here from a suite of things that Fats composed called the London Suite, which he wrote in the late 30s when he was touring. I think it was 38 when he was working in England. And I think as much as anything, it wasn't Fats himself who had the idea to write a piece like this. It was probably his manager, because it made good publicity, I think. I don't know, because it sounds to me, not, and I don't mean this to denigrate Fats Waller and his musicianship at all, but it sounds like, and I think I'm right, that he improvised it on the spot when he recorded it. I don't know, I'm just guessing, but that's the way it feels. And some of the things he plays sound kind of like some of his other pieces, but he's such a great musician that he got it together. And there were six movements in this suite, which was then published after they recorded it, so somebody could transcribe what he played and put it out. And this is one of the movements. They were named after parts of the city of London. What do they call them? I can't remember now. It's not boroughs, is it? What are they? Anyway, this one's called Chelsea. Different from some of the Fats Waller things we've been listening to, I guess. And I don't know if I've played this one in a session. I can't remember. I don't think so. But even if I did, I'm going to play it again then, because it's one of his most beautiful things. It's called the Jitterbug Waltz. and even though it's a waltz, you're still doing the same thing, playing against the steady rhythm. Other than that, there's a little bit of slowing down and speeding up, kind of lyrical piece, but keeping time with your left hand and doing the syncopating with the right. I won't demonstrate that again because no use telling a good joke twice, I guess. Anyway,
How much was what
Walter
was playing? I
was mostly my own arrangement. So. I don't actually have the sheet music for that. I don't know what it looks like. I've heard, heard Fats play it. His recording of it is on organ console in a recording studio with his band, and I don't remember hearing any other like piano solo that he made. But it's still one of his most popular pieces. A lot of us play it, so I guess I made up some of that. But I mean, that's without the raw material, you can't do it. Were you going to ask something? Is he a faker or can he read music?
Do you get a lot of your idea from more from listening to it, or just playing it from what it is and then improvising from there?
Well, if there's a recording of it by the artist in question, it's usually more informative than the sheet music. You know, it depends, though, if it's a transcription of what the guy actually plays, that's something else. But in the old days, certainly when they tried to sell sheet music, they didn't want to write, you know, put anything out for mass consumption that was too hard to play, so they kind of make it easier. And, you know, the jazz is supposed to be golfing a tangent here, but it's a nice one. Jazz is improvisatory, and so was ragtime to a large extent, although somebody like Scott Joplin, who was very serious about his composing, wouldn't be happy if you improvised on his stuff, but most of the sheet music that came out, it might be pretty good. It varied a lot, but it wouldn't be what a professional would play, probably. You know, it just wouldn't. And I had an illustration the other day about how even Joplin's music was not immune from that. Anybody miss? Did you hear it? Can't remember exactly what I said, but somebody like Jelly Roll Morton, for example, they all knew this piece of Joplin's and Maple Leaf Rag. It's his most famous piece, but they would get music and play the other things too. But if they were serious about, you know, wanted to be a competitive piano player, they were going to have their own arrangements of these things. And one more thing about that. Nowadays, you can get transcriptions of all these old performances. You can find them online in all kinds of places. So the mysteries are solved in some cases. And it's very interesting. But I don't know. I guess I'm kind of a nerd when it comes to that stuff. I just look all over the place for these things. Fats Waller, he was a great improviser. But the thing about this particular kind of playing, you find that musicians have trademark things that they play and they'll use them a lot, and that's true of everybody we've talked about, you know. And I guess I'll try to illustrate. there's something that that Fats and all the other guys from the East Coast would do. They use, if you're a piano player, they play this interval thirds, which means a note that's, put your finger on an A and move up two white K's and play the C, and that's a third, 1, 2, 3. And they play a string of these and try to string them together in a sort of tricky way so you can say, what are they doing, you know? Because they're not just playing parallel thirds coming down, but I'll just show you a little bit about that. Just believe me, I'm doing it.
Stuff in between them and all that.
Jelly Roll Martin in New Orleans, and he used to do this a lot. That was one of his tricks. You slide the fingers off the black keys onto the white keys, so you can play this chromatic scale really fast. They're all tricks, and that's what they called them. Ubi Blake, the guy I always cite for that, because he said if you wanted to have your own style, he lived long enough so people would really ask him a lot of questions later on. And to do that, you want to put together your own tricks, that things that other people can't figure out and can't play, and then you'll have your style. And, you know, that's a pretty simple explanation, but it's kind of true. He had one trick that I think is pretty slick. You play this kind of rolling thing in the bass, maybe play the melody of something in the bass, and it was a Ubiism, like this maybe. Way off the track of what I was going to do. Anyway, it doesn't matter. All right, see. Of course, now I have to admit that I need my glasses to read. Nothing but pitfalls in this racket. Okay. Oh, yeah, I was going back to New Orleans for a couple things. Somebody we didn't mention was a band leader from down there, one of the original guys who got out of town, went up north, and made some important recordings in 1923. That was Joe Oliver. He was known as King Oliver, the trumpet player. And he was the king in New Orleans because he was the king of the trumpet players. And they just passed that title around. But his professional name was King Oliver, and his Creole jazz band. But I don't have a trumpet, so I'll have to play it on the piano. This is a tune of his that he recorded in 1923 called The Working Man Blues. That was another piece like I've been playing in just about every session from New Orleans by Jelly Roll Morton, one of his Latin American style things. I got one left, but I won't play it tonight. I'll save it for the concert. Am I forgetting anything? Yeah, but not now. got one more, New Orleans piece. And I guess one of the things I'm doing in this particular session is trying to play some of the slower tempo, more relaxed things, because there's a stereotype sometimes that all this music was kind of fast and with lots of notes. And besides, I want to relax. oh, come on. I mean, no. But I mean, this really, that's what it was about. In New Orleans, for example, no matter how rhythmically exciting the music is at times, part of that is because it's so relaxed. I mean, it really is. It's a paradox, but it's a true paradox. So, what was I going to do here? Oh, yes. This is one of Morton's numbers called the Deep Creek Blues. I think Deep Creek Blues, but on the record label it says Deep Creek. No blues, I don't know, but it is a blues. And it's the kind of thing he used to just toss off pretty casually. He recorded it with his band, one of his recording bands. He was recording for the Victor label for a while, which was a big deal, good to have a contract with this label, and doing pretty well. Then he lost the contract in 1930. Of course, people lost a lot of things at that point. He lost his recording contract. Anyway, this is called Deep Creek. Thank you. was talking about another, this is kind of randomized because I'm trying to fill in gaps and stuff. I'm sorry. And if you have any questions, please interrupt me. There might be better questions than anything I can think of. You never know. We were talking about a guy named Willie the Lion Smith, and he played a couple of things of his, I think it was yesterday. And there's one more that I want to do. He's another East Coast guy. He's quite a character as well. And I actually got to meet him in person, but I unfortunately didn't appreciate him as much as I would if I'd just been a little better educated. I came and played with a band I was with in St. Paul for a weekend at a club we used to operate. And he sat there and played all this beautiful music, and I didn't appreciate it. But he was he had a derby hat, had it cocked on the side of his head, a big cigar, plenty of smoke coming out, too. And it spoke in a sort of enigmatic style. He's got a very bad interview subject. On the other hand, though, he was making the rounds of the talk shows at one time. I saw him on Johnny Carson, I think it was, one of them, one night, and Johnny said to him, "What is stride piano?" And the lion just took a cigar out of his mouth, and he said, "Alternation." That was it. But then he sat down and played, and it was great. He said off-the-wall things all the time. Funny. I think he was on Captain Kangaroo a couple times. And that, I used to watch that, too, before I went to school. I was in college and get up and good program. Anyway, this is the Lion's number called Morning Air. Thank you. Well, that at least has a flavor of it, though. I'm trying to make up an ending because I realize that we're going to run out of time. And it's never a good idea to slap an ending on that you weren't expecting. And I wasn't expecting that one. But I guess it worked out okay. It sounded like it was time to stop anyway. See, I had one more point to make, which I need to read. And also I have a recording to play for you. I don't want to forget this. And I also want to open it up for questions. It's probably the last chance. We've got much too much to do here. And we don't have time to do anywhere near all of it. But I guess the point I'm trying to make here, I guess, with this particular session is simply that there's so much variety, there's no way to cover it all. It's part of it. And, you know, relaxed, easy going. The rhythm is easy. And we're going to make a quick jump here to New Orleans Funeral Parade. And, I mean, it's a quickie, but let's do it. It's not a sad occasion. After they leave the cemetery, they break into this high step and beautiful music. You guys have heard of New Orleans funerals, right? I mean, you know what they do now. Anybody been down there and seen one of those bands marching and all that? This is a recording from 1962 that I'm going to play. And I think it's track 10, if I remember what I told you. But let's talk about it for a second. It's a band called the Eureka Brass Band. That was the top brass band in New Orleans at the time. It was an old and venerable institution as well. And the band leader at the time, when this was recorded in 1962, had been in charge since 1947, I think it was, a trumpet player, Percy Humphrey. And the Humphrey family was an illustrious musical family from New Orleans. And his brother Willie was on clarinet in the band. And it is the closest thing recorded, I think, that sounded like the really old style brass band. We don't really know exactly how they sounded because they didn't record them back then. And of course, the whole thing comes from just the brass band tradition in this country. And there were African American bands as well in New Orleans. And it turned into this miraculous kind of music. They sort of had their own slant on it. I think the tune we're playing here, which one, what is the name of that track? Oh, you can't see it. No, I can't remember which one I picked out. I think it's just a little while to stay here, but I'm not sure. Boy, boy. Preparation. It's wonderful. Yeah, it is. July 2nd, 1962. I was at the recording session, too. That was the first time I'd ever been in New Orleans. And Atlantic Records came down there to record. Essentially, they came because Preservation Hall, which had just opened, was hiring all these musicians, the old-timers, to come and play. And I guess the project was basically to document the music that was being played at Preservation Hall. And it wasn't the first time, nor was it the last time, that they came to New Orleans to record music, figuring they were going to capture the very last vestiges of jazz that had been going on for at least 25 or 30 years. And I remember when I first went to New Orleans, there were those people who said, well, music's nothing like it used to be around here. There's not much point in coming down here to listen to this stuff anymore. And then there were others who were saying, this is the real thing. And we're lucky. And then 2 weeks later, those people were saying, well, jazz is dead. And well, they're still saying it. In 1962, I was 18 years old, and or close to 18. And I was kind of ripe for this kind of experience because I'm a Scandinavian from Minnesota, so everything was the opposite of anything I'd ever seen before. Wonderful food, great music, people talk loud, they laugh all the time, they have parades, they wear costumes. They celebrate life in a way that is, I don't know, I was just kind of blitzed out by this. It wasn't exactly a culture shock, but it was close to that. I don't know how to describe it, but it was never the same after that. Thank goodness. Anyway, so I just was knocked out, and when I play these things from the early 60s, I still, it all comes back. And I don't have time to describe my entire psychological history. But, yeah, goodness. Yeah, you would want to know. I managed to forget some of myself. But why don't we just play this? It's just a little while to stay here. And it's an old hymn. They don't sing it or anything. The instrumentation, they have, by this time, instead of the old E-flat, was it euphonium or something that they used to carry in brass bands back in the old days, they replaced that with the tenor saxophone. But other than that, it's pretty much the old instrumentation. The guy on the saxophone is great anyway, so it doesn't matter. And they have a snare drum and a bass drummer who was phenomenal. Both the drummers are great. And there's a tuba and, you know, the clarinet, the tenor sax, three trumpets and two trombones, and they just make a lot of music. And one other thing about it, I know I talk way too much, but everybody plays all the time. Nobody ever stops playing except maybe one or two of the trumpet players occasionally just to take a breather. But they don't stop for long. It's the ensemble, and this is all pretty much improvised as well. They're not, at this point, they're not reading an old march or anything. This was the one, again, I can't stop myself, but I have to tell you more. The Eureka Band was probably the only one left, or, you know, there wasn't much of this left when I went down there, who would actually have some music with them, and would put it on the lyres, on the horns, and play from it sometimes, but, you know, for funeral dirges and things like that. But for this kind of thing, just marching down the street after they leave the cemetery, it was just everybody plays something different. So you get all this interweaving, kind of like Whitney Ballet at the New Yorker jazz reviewer went to New Orleans, and he said about this particular band, when you heard them coming down the street, he said they lay down a carpet of sound, and that's kind of what it is. So finally we're going to hear it.
Thank you. questions. Yeah.
You mentioned this before, but does this type of music have a special problem with coming to an end?
Well, that particular, that was just supposed to emulate kind of going down the street, you know, you're going to keep going with the drums. You think it's too long? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, not this piece, but no, I see. But winding a piece up so that it comes to a nice conclusion.
Oh, well, I don't know. I hadn't thought about it. What, did I actually say that? Maybe today I said something like that, didn't I? I don't know exactly, but it's interesting that they're trying to simulate the street parade there, even at the end. There was the one thing that was missing from the Atlantic recording session was that nobody thought of asking him to play a dirge, which would have been nice because they played those very sweetly, "Flee as a Bird to the Mountain" and that kind of stuff. And the big wigs were all there from Atlantic Records, and Ahmet Erdogan and Nezui was there too. That's crazy stuff. Anybody else? Oh, yes.
I know your emphasis has been the African American jazz, but when did they all become okay for white men?
Well, they were doing it right from the very beginning. When were Caucasians playing jazz? She says. And I did mention Big Spiderbeck, but and he was one of the early ones who became pretty famous. But in the very earliest days, even in New Orleans, there were Italians and all kinds of people playing what was thought to be sort of the same music, but somehow the African American guys had something else, a different kind of juice in there. Not the case anymore. I mean, I don't think you can say that now. But back in the earliest days of jazz, there was this sort of happy, peppy dance band sound that kind of permeated everything. And they thought that that was jazz. And the jazz age, you know, Fitzgerald's term, was he was talking about some kind of peppy, jazzy things, nothing very profound, I don't think, kind of stuff. He'd go to the country club and dance, you know. But there have been serious white jazz musicians right from the very beginning. And Big Spiderbeck was certainly the most prominent and one of the earlier ones. There still are. There are lots of great music down in New Orleans. I was going to emphasize that. I am not actually, you know, I just love the jazz from the 60s and wish I could have heard it back in the 40s and the 30s and the 20s. But things change. And that's one of the things about it. The music has changed quite a bit in New Orleans. But that doesn't mean we're supposed to get mad about it and tell them to fix it, you know. It just happens. It evolves. That's one of the exciting things about it. And the rhythm is still there in the street. I mean, anytime there's a parade or a lot of what you hear in clubs and things, it just got that sort of feel to it, street music or something. Really something. No matter what they lay on top of it, it's the same stuff. So, you can't stop that from changing. And New Orleans is, for some reason, people from there, musicians from there, the culture is different from other parts of the country. So you might have trouble distinguishing a bebop saxophonist from New Orleans from somebody from New York, but generally speaking, though, that people, it's a closed community down there. All the musicians know each other. They all learn from each other. The people that you hear playing, if they're from there, quite often, they're not people who've been listening to old records to try to figure out how to play. They just grew up with the music, and they play what they got that way, rather than kind of artificial, if you think about it, when somebody like me or, you know, hundreds of thousands of other people, who knows how many, try to do it by going back and listening to old recordings and saying this is how to play. They're not doing that for the most part. It's still, you learn from the older musicians in town, and you grow up with hearing this stuff. It's not, oh, I've got these 1925 records by somebody, and that's how you're supposed to play. It's, this is how you play down at the place down the street. This is how my uncle did it. It's just, you know, it's more like that. So it's different. And I don't know, it's something about it that I find magical. Anybody have any other questions? Yes, sir.
I'm worried about the relationship between the emotion having the blues and then the blues genre. And for the composer, is there any ever relationship between the emotion and the style?
Yeah, the blues, it's generally thought of as sad music, though it isn't always. But, you know, like, there's a lot of blues that's just plain funny, or whatever. But, yeah, I don't know exactly how to address it, but it was, you know, it was, of course, vocal music to begin with. And people just use it to release some emotion or tension or something. And now it's also a kind of strict form, 12-measure chorus, whatever, but didn't start out that way, I'm sure. And I think basically to have the blues, that term comes from the music, and it's generally thought of as sad, but it's also kind of celebratory and what's the word I'm trying to think of? I can't think of it. Oh, man.
Participatory.
I don't mean relief. What am I trying to say? Anyway.
Cathartic?
Cathartic. Yes. Good work. All right. Thank you. it's a wonderful blues verses. The form is kind of cool, like I was saying. It's sort of like, in a way, it's sort of like calypso in one particular anyway, and then I think originally the singer would be extemporizing and making it up, you know, and it could be pretty good. Like, there's some funny stuff there. Louis Armstrong had one. But, he said, I'm going to grab me a picket off somebody's fence. And then, you know, like you do, got to think about that for a minute and see how we're going to say something that rhymes to it. So you sing the same line again. Grab me a picket from somebody's fence. Gonna beat you over your big head until you learn some sense. It's wonderful. So it can be kind of funny too. I don't know why I said that. I just thought it was anybody. Cathartic is the word. That was perfect. Yeah.
But you talked about a Chicago style, a New York style. Was there a West style, an LA style, a Hollywood style?
Well, there's a lot of jazz in California. Even before they started recording the music. But guess what? Some of the more important musicians came from New Orleans. They moved out there and stayed. But not all of them were. Not a whole lot of recordings by, that I've heard at least, probably they don't really exist, by West Coast-born jazz musicians, but they were doing it. But they also, in interviews and things that I've read and scholarship on this, they say that these old-time musicians were interviewed while they were still alive, you know, and people were researching this later, and they were saying that they learned a lot from, or were at least influenced by, the people from New Orleans who came out to settle there. The climate was better. Kid Ory, a great trombonist from New Orleans, very famous because he made a lot of recordings from the 20s through the 40s and 50s, but he moved for his health. You know, doctor said, well, you'd probably feel better if you go out west, so he did. Las Vegas was on the way out there, too, and some of the people would stop off there and, play in some of the places. Or Jelly Roll Morton's common-law wife, Anita Gonzalez, whose real name was Bessie Johnson, but anyway, she went to Las Vegas and opened up a place. I guess it was kind of a nightclub, among other things, gambling house, whatever. And she had music, and Morton himself played there some, and Kid Ory and the guys would play there on their way through. But they were on their way to the coast. Yeah. Anybody else?
So
more or less.
What distinguishes ragtime from boogie woogie is that also kind of form?
Yeah, the form is. I guess I keep trying to talk about the commonalities between all of them because I'm just talking about the ground beating and the syncopation, but blues and boogie-woogie are pretty much the same structure. You know, it's a 12-bar deal most of the time, not always. But the way you play as well, I mean, we don't have time to do a whole lot with it, but in ragtime and in a lot of the early jazz styles we've been talking a lot about, like from New York, you play this boom chick kind of thing. And some people say that's why you call it stride piano, because you're striding up and down. But it's not really quite like that, because you do that in a lot of other kinds of music too. Polkas, for example, or marches sometimes when they're in that kind of time signature. And so, in Chopin, I mean, who knows? That's how you do the left hand varies in boogie woogie. It's this down in the bottom, and it's repetitive pattern over and over. I don't have time now to do this because I see people are already coming to church. I want to thank you guys. How many were at the movie? Okay. Well, you get an A. Yeah. We have a concert tomorrow night, so I'll see some of you then. Any of you guys have to leave tomorrow? Okay. One more?
Sure.
Good grief. Oh. I see. All right. Well, these people don't know what they're in for.